This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
All good. How you doing, Jen?
How's it going with you?
It's pretty good. Yeah, we've got a few questions coming up. And
yeah, that's it. No more foreplay. It's you know, it's just not worth the trouble.
Clearly speaking from experience. God, our poor listeners. I swear, if they haven't come up with a drinking game for this yet, they should.
Drinking carrot juice or what?
Oh, my goodness.
Of course.
All right. Well, let's just pause. Maven, how you doing? What's going on? What's new in your life?
Well, the only thing better than foreplay is like resentful foreplay. That's what female doesn't love that? Jesus.
That's just priceless. Oh my God.
It's the great. Just warming up here in Southern California. Yeah.
That's nice. That's nice. Sounds good.
Okay. That's good. That's enough.
Cool. How are you doing, Jen?
I'm just fine.
Are the dogs all
Thanks
good?
For checking in.
Oh my God, this is too good.
Oh my God. All right,
we'll just jump in now. That's it.
Get on with it.
Yeah, okay. Get on with it. Get right. It over with.
Fly back and think of England.
Oh God. It's really worth provoking her just to find out what comes out of her mouth. It's just great. It's just fabulous.
Recurring theme in my relationships.
Yeah.
Now we can get to some small talk.
Oh my goodness.
Dr. Hawk, you got me interested now.
So. Yeah. We'll circle around to that.
Circle back in the words of...
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. All right, let's do a show. Let's do a show.
All right, now we'll do a show.
What do we got?
Okay. All right, let's do it. Let's go on.
All right. Dear doctors, for the past 20 years, I have been bewildered and somewhat disappointed in how my ex-husband and two adult sons have been difficult to get along with and very dismissive of me. Despite my huge efforts to forge a warm and close feeling among the four of us, no matter how hard I try, I keep getting rejection and sometimes even ridicule from these guys, even though none of us live together anymore. Now, finally, I realized that the problem maybe isn't me, i.e., it's not that I'm not a good enough mother or a good enough wife. Perhaps it's their personalities. They would all score pretty high on the disagreeable bell curve, while I am in the high 80s for agreeableness. So now what? Is there a different strategy I should now take with these family members? Or should I just give up and head for the hills? I'd appreciate any help. I love these people, but I just don't enjoy being with them anymore.
That is a fabulous question.
It really covers a lot of ground.
Yeah, that is fabulous. That is, you know, front and center of one of life's great dilemmas, and how it is that if we're trying to identify the right strategies to live your life in the best way, this is a great question to highlight, you know, what's an ideal strategy. So let's, Jen, let's just have your take. What are your first impressions of this?
Well, yeah, it's getting to the heart of so many things that we talk about all the time. First and foremost, the sort of tyranny of personality. So it sounds like a lot in how she's asking this question. She's come to the realization that she can't change these people. You're dealing with a lot of disagreeableness, and as an agreeable person, this is just conflict central for you. It's really just there are very few things that you can experience with these human beings that are going to be pleasurable. It's especially now that you're divorced and you've got these kids who have half of their genes coming from their disagreeable dad, sounds like. It's just you're going to find yourself running into conflicts of interest around activities and negotiations and conversations for which that there would not be a conflict of interest with people who are less disagreeable, more agreeable like yourself. So it's just shitty, and it's hard, and you've had enough experience with this now that your cost benefit analysis is starting to tell you it's not worth it. The payoff that maybe we had some good times in the past, you don't hate them. You have obviously a lot of shared interest and a lot of shared memories. But again and again, you've gotten the evidence, your nervous system has integrated evidence that, you go in and you wind up being taken advantage of, your goodwill gets chiseled, they wind up making a big stink about something that you don't think is worth making a stink about, all the things that disagreeable people will do that are very high cost to agreeable people. And it has just taken you a certain amount of time and a number of repeated interactions to finally get to the point where you're starting to accept that this is true. And so that takes us into what we call the disagreeable distance, which is just that you make your peace with the fact that you can't change these people. It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with what a good wife or mother you are. And this is the lifelong lesson that agreeable people have to continually learn until they get it, is that, yeah, there's nothing that you can do to change their personality in any kind of permanent way. And so this is them. This is who they are. And it's up to you to create this disagreeable distance and to create a life that, sits parallel with them and has some amount of overlap to the degree that it makes sense and that you find it pleasant and beneficial to do so, but not out of any misguided sense of obligation because you happen to share some genetic material with these kids and some sunk cost and good memories with the ex. It's really about looking forward and saying, okay, well, maybe we're gonna hang out under these conditions, these very specific conditions for these very specific moments of time, for holidays or important key dates of the year, whatever that happens to look like. But not more than that. And to not get into the agreeable, particularly the agreeable conscientious trap, which is that you feel some sort of misguided obligation because you want to be good. You want to take the high road and you're just cannibalizing your own life experience by doing that. So it sounds like you're already there. This is the wonderful old Zen saying, which is that you must not learn. You do not need to learn to let anything go. You just need to learn to recognize it is already gone. And this relationship with all three of these people is already gone. There's really nothing there that's particularly worth salvaging or salvageable, even if you wanted to salvage it. So it's about managing your experience going forward.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dr. Hawk.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Super comprehensive. I want to, I'll take this opportunity on this. There's nothing more for me to say about the decision-making process and the analysis of it. The only thing that comes to mind for me is to back the camera up one notch and look at it even wider, which is that people's personalities don't change at all. The only thing that changes in your life is your perception of the environment. And so the environment that matters is going to be the only environment that makes any impact on you is going to be what we're going to call the perceived environment. So if I suddenly convinced everybody that, some stock was going to go sky high because I got an inside tip, that would influence your perceived your environment about what you think the best thing is to do with any money that you've got rattling around in an investment account or something like this. So it's your perceived environment is the real environment ultimately becomes the perceived environment when it hits you over the head. But when those features, so you're just so sure it's going to be warm and sunny out there today because that's what the weather report said. And so you actually plan your day tomorrow on your perception of what you think is going to happen. And then it turns out, oh no, it's not going to be what's going to happen. And then it turns out that you then change your behavior with response to that. So the changes in perception of the perceived environment is going to be what we call learning. And you're actually learning every second. In other words, as you move your head around and as your ears do the work that they do and all your sense organs do the work that they do, what you have is a flow of new information that is constantly coming into your nervous system, and it's updating your perception of the environment. Now, you don't even notice this because the updates of the perception of the environment are minuscule. But let's suppose you're a new parent, and so everything's quiet and you're sort of relaxing and your mind is drifting to different problems of life. And then suddenly your newborn starts to scream. Okay. So now you've got a perception of the environment that we've got distress there. And now that becomes super important to respond to that and figure out what we're going to do about it. So you're constantly, quote, learning. And what will happen at times is that you'll figure out that sometimes your perceptions of the environment have been deeply flawed. And this is what will happen at such times. It may be that you thought that you had a great deal more status with an individual, and then a showdown takes place where they need to take sides on something, and it turns out they're not with you after all, that they're on somebody else's team. And so that quote is now you learn something. Your perception of the environment was different than the reality. And you feel, quote, betrayed. Okay. So all kinds of things can work this way. So when you have a big misunderstanding, in other words, you have an illusion about what the facts are of reality, and then a significant informational event comes to the fore, and you have a huge learning process that takes place. This is going to be what we call a paradigm shift, okay? And it's not what it is that it's a whole, you know, it's possible, no matter how, if this reaches pretty far, that the paradigm shift literally can change every little tiny bit of information. Literally, as you wiggle your toe in your sock and you feel something slightly sharp in there, perhaps, that is a new update of information that will slightly alter your behavior. All the way to a paradigm shift when you find out that, I don't know, your best friend has been embezzling from your joint business account and you've got a hell of a lot less money than you thought you had and you're not sure what you're going to do about it and it's a crisis. Okay. So, what's happening in moments of disillusionment is that the illusion has been stripped away by a new, more accurate perception. And what happens then is that this leads us to a better future. So as Jen was saying, that Zen, it's so good that she studied all this stuff that I never did.
Just hung out with some hippies.
But that's a beautiful saying and something I hadn't heard, it's already been lost. All that you're losing now is the illusion. And with the disillusionment, often it can be a painful disillusionment as we go through the emotional reaction to this shift of loss, as if the loss process is taking place during the moment of realization, when actually it's been a process that's much longer than that. However, if we get down to a beautiful, pithy insight of John Wooden's, which is that when you lose, don't lose the lesson. So in this case, the lesson is that that people's personalities don't change. And this is something, this is one of the grand illusions of human nature. And as Jen has pointed out, it's an incentivized, taught illusion, and it is the great illusion of social science. And it's a huge corrupting concept in social science. It leads to a tremendous amount of misunderstanding, unbelievable misinvestment in time and energy trying to change your children into things that they aren't, and, quote, working on relationships that are doomed because of the emergent properties of the two individuals and who and what it is that they value. And then finally, in this sort of situation, that, you know, working on your relationships with your adult children, for God's sakes. No, we don't work at these things. This is, it would be a rare instance where we might be highly motivated to discover if we're having a misunderstanding about some signaling that goes on typically early in relationships. Okay, so in the early months of relationship, people can be leaping to conclusions and be very antsy and worried about what it is that they're seeing and really not understand exactly what the other person is up to and why. And so that can transpire. 3 years in, 20 years in, forget it. There's no misunderstanding of what the hell is happening. What's happening is the emergent properties of the nature of the individuals that are involved. And so once we see, one of the great insights is that, oh no, they do not change. The personalities do not change. The relationships fundamentally are just emergent properties, and the relationships can shift around based on how much illusion there is in the individuals. So you can feel like, oh, okay, well, that was a mess, but now we sort of kissed and made up and things are good again. Sure they are. Yeah, they're good again until the next disillusionment incident, that where once again we remap what it is that our worst fear was, and it turns out that the guy or the girl is just as messed up the way we feared before in the last crisis. So, you know, I don't know, maybe you don't have a second crisis, but maybe you do. And then you become, quote, disillusioned. And upon that, you improve your perception of the reality of the environment. And with that, are the keys to your better future. And so everything that Jen said about this situation, you know, applies to all relationships of all people. It's all about recognizing the personalities are intractable. The only thing that changes is our perception of the environment. And with that, you know, those are the keys to your better future. That if you've had a long-term mediocre relationship, you know, think hard about whether or not, you know, what kind of investment and what kind of time and energy you want to put into it. My answer is, you know, move a healthy chunk in the direction of less overlap in the Venn diagram between your life and your adult life, i.e. the disagreeable distance. Try that as a nice experiment and see if your life improves. That's how we make the big decisions about changes in relationships. We make them in increments, and then we follow the evidence by monitoring essentially what life feels like. So I think that's, I hope that's good enough.
Yeah, I think there, just to add in a little more explicitly, you touched on this, but just to make it more clear for people, because it's important, particularly for the agreeables and the agreeables with the sucker triad, especially, so that you can get the conscientiousness, you get the codependence, basically, is what a typical kind of pop psychologist would call this. But you have watched their personality change. So there's some confusion because they are more disagreeable than they used to be. You do you probably do remember when days were better, and that may not have just been at the beginning. It may have definitely been at the beginning when people always are overselling their agreeableness and their their conscientiousness. But if you're dealing with real disagreeables, it probably also got better when they needed something from you.
Yes.
You know, when they were acting in an opportunistic way and a manipulative way. So this is where all the kind of conventional pop psychology discussion of narcissism comes in, which is really just a synonym for disagreeable. So, you know, if a narcissist narcissistic personality, i.e. a really disagreeable person, is viewing the world as unfair, cutting them a raw deal, and they deserve better, which is essentially how they're going through life most of the time, they can really deliberately improve your cost benefit on the relationship in a way that you subjectively as the agreeable feel is, oh, well, things are better now.
Right.
So things, we're getting along, we're not fighting as much, he's not saying shitty things to me anymore, he's not making fun of me, things are better. And so the inferential processes in your noggin are trying to figure out, what did I do to make that different? How did I, maybe now I'm being a good wife and a good mother to cause the relationship to go in this different direction, not realizing that you're really just sort of a pawn in this larger game of chess that this person is playing to get what they want, which is based on this very unequal perception of what fair is. So, to the degree that you fit into that scheme moment by moment, whatever it happens to be, in an expeditious way, then it can be all hearts and flowers and unicorn farts and cupcakes for you. And it might look really nice and feel really good, and it's going to contribute to really good memories and feeling like, well, we did, we've had good times. Sometimes it's bad, but then it's good again. So that's not the personality changing. That's right. That's the environmental context and the opportunity structure of that opportunistic person behaving in a deliberate way to get what they want.
Beautiful. Absolutely. Great, Jen. Thank you. That's important. Yeah. If we look closely, what we see is that there's a regression line. In other words, there's a statistical description of this relationship, and any given week or day is bouncing around that particular line. And it can, there can be some variance, but the truth is if we, when I say that relationships are emergent properties and the people don't change, that the emotional character of that relationship, over time, it's triangulating, quote, on the truth. And it's always bending that direction. An outlier either to the good or to the ill is it pretty soon the next set of experiences will regress back towards that mean. And what we need to do is back up and look at the history of something. And I don't have a lot of willingness to put up with too much unless I see that the overall CB is very good. That's the idea is that you know an awful lot. Certainly, you know a lot in a few months, but you know a hell of a lot in a year. Kind of what is the mean payoff emotionally in this relationship? You can estimate that very well. And this lady, undoubtedly, and people that are in relationships that are highly conflicted because of difficult personalities, you can give a very good estimation by the end of a year of what the next 20 are going to feel like. It's not likely to be a phenomenal surprise. And so particularly if you're 10 or 20 years in, if you're 20 years in, you know what number 21 is going to be. So that's, all we have to do is
you know what it's going to be. You certainly know the best case scenario, but it could get worse, if anything,
yeah, right.
you're overestimating, because, if that disagreeable person, gets a bad health diagnosis or gets, hit by a taxi cab or, loses their job or any number of things that befall people, that they're very likely to not deal with that very well relative to how an agreeable person would. And their cost just went up to you in terms of the relationship. So kind of the slings and arrows of life, if anything, the inferences that you're making early in a relationship of what it's going to be like, that's kind of like the best that it's going to be, without controlling for the fact that shit happens. Shit almost certainly happens over the long haul. So you have to have some room for that.
You know what? There's just no human on earth could possibly be that smart conceptually. This must have come from experience. No, that is ingenious. And I sit back in awe at the conceptual accuracy of that, because I think that's exactly how it is. It's beautiful, Jen.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely experience the school of hard knocks, as they say.
Oh, my. All right, Nathan, let's see what else we got.
Well, yeah, I've got sure. So if we can talk a little bit more about this question. So
sure.
her final question was, should I give up and head for the hills?
And
I know that you guys have talked before on different shows that there are some obstacles that are sometimes standing in people's way. In her case, she's already divorced, but if she was married, then that would be an obstacle as to do all the legal proceedings and all the stuff required to essentially break free. What sorts of things would you like, what would that look like for her to head for the hills, essentially, if she has determined that that's the right move?
It's basically looking at the, if you think of your life and your time and energy in a Venn diagram, the old Venn diagrams that you learn intersection, in fourth grade. And then you look at other people's lives as another circle in the Venn diagram. And so for her, for example, she's got some amount of intersection with her two difficult sons and her ex, and pretending that somehow this is a confederation of a existing but altered family. And the truth is that that's how she's been looking at it, and that's really, she's looking at it through a fading delusion. And so what we need to do is, if she's been overlapping her sort of time and energy about the relationships and the investments that she's making in certain relationships, and it turns out that of her pie of relationships, 14% goes to son number one, 15% goes to son number two, 4% goes to the ex. And so between them, I don't know what it is, at 33% of her energy or something like that. It's too much. So what we're going to do is we're going to go from 33 down to about 17, which means that, are we going to get together twice a year? No, this next year it's going to be once. Okay. And instead of, talking on the phone once a week, we're going to fade it down to skipping every other week for a while. And what we're going to do is we're going to get used to those new equilibria, and we're going to see what it feels like. And if it turns out that if it feels good, then the phone calls are going to go from every other week to once a month. Okay. And so this is, we're going to keep fading until we find a level that feels, not only better, but it feels very acceptable, and where we actually feel motivated, like, okay, that was a good thing to do. So people know my great friend, Alan Goldhammer.
And I was actually wondering if we could get through a big question about disagreeable people, but like, how long? 27 minutes before we mentioned either Alan or Larry. So I'm impressed.
So Alan once stunned me, and I probably told this story on him before. But he stunned me that I don't know what we were doing. We were, playing Stratego with our amped up rules, because that's always an interesting thing to do, that this piece can move in this way now, but the rules say it can't, but now we decided it can, it's like wild cards in poker, make it all more exciting.
Nerd so, alert. Had to be said.
Talk nerdy to us, Dr. Lyle. Talk nerdy to us.
Well, that's why I got a harem here in my house, for crying out loud. Did you see this? So anyway, and he looks up at the clock and says, oh, hold on a second. And he calls up, I don't know how old we were. We were probably 40. And he calls up his parents, and he talks to them for 10 minutes. And then, okay, I got you. All right, well, good talking to you. Boom, hangs up. And I said, what was that? He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, yeah, I have to call them 10 minutes before their favorite show. So... So that's what he did. Every week they had a favorite show that they watched on whatever night it was, and he'd call them up 10 minutes before, talk to them, and then they'd say, hey, our show's up, and that's it. That's what he did. Unbelievable.
They didn't catch on to this. It seems like they'd put their own regression line together at some point.
No, I'm sure if they did, whatever. I don't think they did. And he's crafty enough. You know, he'd mix it up. He'd go 20 minutes one time.
That's true. He's pretty crafty.
Oh, he's very crafty. Yeah. So anyway, that's the disagreeable distance right there. That's a good example. Alan and the favorite show. That's how we do it.
I think we often miss with that. It's difficult for people. I mean, disagreeable distance has always kind of come naturally to me, which is, I think, unusual as a high agreeable. But, I have no problem really if I'm really getting chiseled to death in a disagreeable relationship. I have no problem fading to black and ghosting that person, as you have seen me do.
Yeah.
And so, but I think it does not come naturally to most agreeables, and particularly for this questioner who, we're assuming you're middle-aged and, have adult kids, like depending on the circumstances of your social life beyond your family, it's going to be even harder because you're sort of, as you disconnect from them, if they're providing the bulk of your social connection and your meaning in your life and just sort of, you've kind of built your whole life and identity around this family, it's going to be a different question what it means to run for the hills for somebody who has a really strong friend network and work connections and everything else than for somebody who doesn't. And I talk to a lot of people who don't, have a lot of life outside of these kind of mediocre relationships with their ex or their adult kids or whatever it is. So that's something just to keep in mind, that if you're feeling it's particularly difficult to disconnect, you might need to just crowd it out with other activities and other relationships, and that can help manage that whole problem. You'll feel like you're losing less than you really are if that's the situation that you're in.
Yeah. I mean, this is a problem of, this is the equivalent of a misinvestment. And so we've misinvested in probably, in this case, she's got these two adult sons. They're very disagreeable. Outside, lingering out there, waving in the future, are grandchildren. Those are the only possible grandchildren that she would ever have. She doesn't have a nice, sweet daughter that she's well connected with, that therefore she has the inside track on grandmotherhood. No, not if these guys get married or have kids with somebody and have kids with partners, it's the maternal grandmother that has the inside track on everything. And so so as a result, that's kind of in trouble as a concept. And also, I wouldn't be waiting around too long, because a lot of times those things don't work out anything like the way we would hope for, not the way that we learned in the 1950s that they were going to work out. This isn't Walton's Mountain anymore. And so as a result, that's probably, and the idea that these kids lingering, waving out there in the future is your own future, your own possible disability, possible bizarre and unanticipated financial constraints on your existence in your old age. So essentially, your children are insurance policies, and they're already signaling that they're not interested and that they are exceedingly difficult to deal with. And so as a result, they're bad insurance policies. So the disillusionment of what takes place when we look with clear eyes at what it is that we're really looking at is really the realization of a misinvestment. It's like, oh, well, you work for PG&E and then Enron bankrupted that retirement fund, and now you're 52 years old and you don't have a retirement. It's like, okay, all right. That is a shock, and it's horrendous, and it's an unearned disaster. But what do we do now? Answer: we get smart. We invest in sound processes from here. That's what we do. We don't chase some legal process and hope to win in some fiasco where Enron is bankrupt, PG&E is bankrupt, and everybody's bankrupt, and we're hoping for something. It's like, no. That's not a good strategy. The good strategy is to start investing in soundly in your future, which means new people, new relationships, your own abilities, etc. And if finances have nothing to do with any of this, which let's hope they don't, the issue is if it's purely emotional and those of connection, your job is to go to the trouble to go find and forge relationships with people that really like you. And wow, what a rich thing in your life to have. 10 years ago, I don't believe I knew Nathan. And I think 5 years ago, I did not know Jen. Those two people are now important people. Now, quite frankly, Jen's a lot more important than Nathan, but you know, everybody can see that. But the point of all this is that, wow, like my life is richer and more secure. There's like more spokes, you know, to my little table that, you know, there's more feet on the table. There's more stability to it. I've got more sources of support and two more people that I enjoy in this existence that I didn't even know were here 10 years ago. That's an investment. Okay. And with that investment, do I feel more secure? Yeah. All I have to do is start thinking, God, what do I think about anything? I'm kind of insecure about my opinion. I better call Jen and find out what I think.
or call Jen and talk about libertarian political economy. So
oh,
that's
yeah.
always good, too.
Yeah, I'll get all upset then.
It's time to parameterize.
That's it. But no, this is what we do. And this is how we make our life better by investing in people where we can tell that the payoff's good. And that's what we want to do. And that's what she needs to do. And that's heading for the hills. You don't need to hit. She's saying, do I just walk off and leave these relationships? No, we fade them down and we find out, you know, how loud that music should be. And it's going to be a lot quieter than it is. That's how we do it.
Yeah, implied in Head for the Hills, there's the last ditch strategy of the agreeable, which is to, you know, well, if they see me threatening to leave, then they'll get straight. They'll be nice. You know, things will go back to, you know, they'll suddenly value me. And that sounds pretty unlikely in this case. So there's not a lot to be gained with, you know, making a big noise about leaving and I've had it with this and this is unfair and I can't stand being treated this way anymore. Because you're not going to move the needle that much on how they're behaving. So that can be a useful strategy if someone is acting in a way that is, they're in a distorted information environment, they don't realize that they could lose you over it. And they have moved to a disagreeable equilibrium based on their position of power that you could light a little fire under and shift it back toward your direction. But I don't think that's what you're seeing here. So I think you're holding on to this hope that if you make that noise, that they're going to get whipped into shape. And that's very unlikely to happen. So
Yeah.
What you're talking about, too, with building the social foundation and replacing the insurance policy harkens back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, which is that you also you can't bring those expectations of any insurance policy in your life in this moment for 20 years down the road for anybody, whether it's a spouse or your adult kids or the new best friend that you meet at your pottery class. Nobody's a guarantee that they're going to be there and that insurance policy is going to be paying off in the way that you want it to and expect it to as you're investing in it today. All you can do is act in your best interest today in a way that optimizes your happiness and your life experience, not with the sort of like, well, I'm doing this now, even though, you know, it's not necessarily what I want to be doing and it's kind of mediocre, but I really am going to need friends when I'm old and lonely because that's putting a burden on those relationships, whether you're related to them or not, that is unfair and unrealistic.
Yeah. Sounds like signing a one-way contract and the other person didn't know they signed, right?
Yeah, I think people, well, that's what a lot of these adult children insurance policies are too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that's why there can be resentment there and there can be, you know, really kind of confused parents who don't understand why, you know, why this isn't paying off in the way that they expected it to.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, you want to take one quick question about landscapes and then and wrap it up?
Sure.
Yeah, why not?
Okay. All right, dear doctors, you've talked about how people enjoy landscapes that indicate that safety, food, and water needs will be met. But why do people feel a sense of wonder and awe at the night sky, a newborn's hand, or something like the Grand Canyon? Are these feelings related to religious experiences? are there personality traits that would be more likely in people who have frequent experiences of awe and wonder?
Well, I know what my guess is, Jen.
I'll let you tackle this one. I think there are personality differences among people who have more frequent experiences of awe and wonder, i.e. they're more open to experience. They're, mm-hmm. they're, you know, whack jobs like myself.
Yeah.
So they have a larger, we've called it a mystic chip. It's just mm-hmm. high openness. That is something that makes you more inclined to feel this way about things that you interact with in the natural world. But there are good reasons for good adaptive reasons for these things too, which I've heard Doug speak very eloquently about. So you should take off on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that it's been sexually selected. And so I think it's likely that religiosity has been sexually selected. Spiritualness has been sexually selected. What we mean by that is that if you have those feelings and then you express them, as this went down in the Stone Age in the last couple of million years, that is sexier. It makes you more interesting. And so I think that... One of the most astounding insights that I ever read in evolutionary psychology was in The Mating Mind, of which there was many astounding insights in The Mating Mind. But the most, the high concept in The Mating Mind that just knocked me off my chair in just sheer admiration of Jeffrey Miller was the notion that feelings have been sexually selected. That literally how you feel is a display process in order to be sexually attractive. And I mean, that is such, and keep in mind, you're talking to a trained cognitive behavioral therapist who learned at the feet of the gods of CBT that, you know, what you feel is based on what you think. And, you know, what you think are these automatic thoughts and God knows where they came from. That's the black box they can't get into. But obviously, your feelings are derivative of what you think. We can see that there's a logical relationship that would make complete sense. So then you start thinking, okay, well, if I'm feeling spiritual, it's clearly because I'm thinking about the possibility of spiritually connected, you know, energy, moral processes in the universe. Okay, where the hell would that come from? Okay, well, that's the black box that Jeffrey Miller looks inside and says, well, the whole kit and caboodle is sexually selected. And so that would make perfect sense. All that it would take would be to have a little bit of that feeling and the expression of that feeling a little bit somewhere in a campfire, you know, 787,000 years ago, when the dawn of language, when there's only like 400 words, but it's enough. And somebody has a feeling of awe looking at the stars, expresses it, and then somebody else says, wow, that's pretty cool. That's an interesting and nice feeling that you have. Think about how obvious this is, about how women might look at a guy who treats his pet really nicely, like his dog, okay? And think about what that is. It's like, wow, I really find the fact that that guy is having those feelings is highly appealing, okay? And so then we start realizing, okay, the truth is that feelings are absolutely critically important displays. And that's why, you know, I was always embarrassed the way Alan would treat waitresses, you know, and it's because, whoa, your disagreeable ability is leaking out all over the place, dude. Making me look bad. And it was always uncomfortable in those circumstances. And so, you know, Alan makes a lot of us uncomfortable, makes Jennifer, his wife, uncomfortable a lot of times because he's not meaning to be difficult. He's just feeling annoyed and irritated, and you're chiseling 3 minutes of his life because you're moving a little slow. And you know, he's you know, he doesn't snarl loudly, but he lets you know he's not happy. And so when we start realizing, oh, wow, of course this is true, that the nature and content of another person's emotional life is of prime importance, not obviously not only, I mean, in all human relationships, in friendship, in trade, and absolutely in romance. So when we start looking at any interesting feeling, we are, you know, some curious, interesting feeling. It's like, well, why would that feeling exist? You know, there's two reasons to, there's only two paths to derive why that feeling exists. One of them is survival. What possible good would awe have looking at the Grand Canyon or the stars in the sky when it comes to survival? I see no benefit whatsoever for those feelings. Okay. If that were true, my cat would have those feelings. And we'd see cats looking up in awe at the moon or whatever. They don't.
You don't know. You're not watching that cat 24/7. Rich inner life.
Well, Jen, my cats look at me with those feelings, baby. But no, I think that we can clearly see if it's not for survival, which it's not, where the elephants would be having those feelings. No, it must be for reproduction.
Yeah, and it's not that it's staring at the sky having the feeling that is selected. I mean, that's sort of selected on the way to what is really selected, which is talking about it.
So, right.
Like when was the last time, ladies, you went on a date with a guy who talked about his trip to the Grand Canyon and how humbled in the face of the forces of nature he was? Like, he's got to tell you the story. The whole point is of having the experience is to tell you the story so he can look really deep and really profound and really connected to something bigger than, you know, there's something different about him. He's special.
He will still love you tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Because he's never met anybody like you before in all of his travels when he's been so awed by the forces of the universe. So it's really like, yes, we do feel this feeling and that is sort of the byproduct of what's really being selected, which is narrating the feeling and eliciting this feeling of connection, particularly from a male to a female, like, don't you feel that too? Well, we have there's something special here that we have that nobody else has because I am basically born out of Zeus's forehead. And so here I am. You better mate with me while you have a chance.
Boy, does this ever explain my failures in this arena?
Yeah.
Our next broadcast will be from the Grand Canyon in Arizona.
Yeah,
these things don't happen in a vacuum. I mean, it's nobody is having these sort of profound experiences without at least imagining narrating it to somebody.
Yes.
So yeah, you can come back and say, oh well, I had this really profound experience under the night sky, and I felt like I was sucked up into the vortex of the Milky Way, and I was at one with the universe, and I wasn't even on mushrooms. Like, cool, but and I never wanted to tell anyone about it. I just wrote about it in my journal, and so it wasn't a display. It wasn't a virtue signal. It was just my own feeling, my own experience. But you were displaying it to your internal audience. You were rehearsing it. And so this is what Miller tells us in this amazing book, which really it's one of my favorite evolutionary psychology books of all time. And it's really lyrically beautifully written, of course, which he acknowledges is a meta display.
It worked.
Oh, totally. It worked. Yeah. Totally worked. Yeah. So it's a great resource. And these are not just sexually selected processes, but they're mostly runaway sexually selected processes.
Yes.
Very attractive. Big difference between the guy sitting around the campfire who has the sense of awe and can tell you about it and make you feel more connected to him than the guy who's like, dinner. went, eat. not oh, I prayed for the spirit of the elk to give itself over to us so we could all share in this bounty together and you know that we may feast as soulmates.
Yeah, there you go. Beautiful.
Well, Dr. Hall.
Yeah, I think
go ahead, Dr. Hall.
Go ahead, Nathan. No, we're done. This is like the after play now, or what do you call that, Jen? What do you call it at the end?
Aftercare.
Oh my god. This is why the new podcast is called Hawk Blocked. This is Hawk Blocked. I'm doing the little thing with my arms. It's like, yep, yep. No, shut it down.
We haven't heard the toxic masculinity alarm in a long time, Dr. Lau. Oh, so I think things
that's
are getting
true.
Better.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
That's well. I've just that been that off. Beaten down by the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's my false consciousness that has taken over the situation. Like not even alert to violations anymore.
All good, good. All right, Nathan.
Well, Dr. Lyle, right. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. Really, really love it. So we will look forward to talking to you both in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, you know, maybe a visit to the Grand Canyon or a look at the stars is in order, Dr.
Yeah, I hear you. We'll work on that.
We'll get some photos for your yeah. for your dating site.
You there know, you go. Like, that's good.
With your look of awe.
Yeah, that's what we need. That's what's needed. That's good thinking.
How can we convert this to a display? Always, good. That's always a question.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right, folks. Great All talking right. to you both.
All right.
All right. Guys, have a good night.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.